Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Global Crisis, War, Climate Change and Catastrophe in the 17th Century, by Geoffrey Parker, narrated by Peter Noble. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to figures, tables and plates present in the print and e-book formats of the book. It was so harsh a winter that no one could remember another like it. Only after Easter could the peasants go to their fields and begin to farm. Hans Heberle, Zeitregister, Diary, Ulm, Germany, 1627. The times here are so miserable that never in the memory of man has the like famine and mortality happened. East India Company officials. Letter, Surat, India, 1631. Those who live in times to come will not believe that we who are alive now have suffered such toil, pain, and misery. Fra Francesco Voercio of Cherasco, Diario del Contagio, Plague Diary, Italy, 1631. There have been so many deaths that the like of it has never been heard in human history. Hans Conrad Lang, Tagebuch, Diary, South Germany, 1634. Jiang Nan has never experienced this kind of disaster. Lu Shiyi, Shi Shui Lu, Diary, South China, 1641. Among all the past occurrences of disaster and rebellion, there had never been anything worse than this. County Gazetteer, Yizhou, North China, 1641. The whole monarchy trembled and shook, since Portugal, Catalonia, the East Indies, the Azores, and Brazil had rebelled. Viceroy Don Juan de Palafox y Mendoza, Mexico, 1641. These days are days of shaking, and this shaking is universal. The Palatinate, Bohemia, Germany, Catalonia, Portugal, Ireland, England. Jeremiah Whittaker, Ereno Poyos, The Peacemaker, England, 1643. This seems to be one of the epochs in which every nation is turned upside down, leading some great minds to suspect that we are approaching the end of the world. Nicandro, The Victor, Pamphlet, Madrid, Spain, 1643. 'Tis true, we have had many such black days in England in former ages, but those paralleled to the present are to the shadow of a mountain compared to the eclipse of the moon. James Howell, Collected Letters, England, 1647. There was great hunger throughout the Christian world. Inscription, Old Sambor Cathedral, Ukraine, 1648. The prices of victual and corns of all sorts were higher than ever heretofore anyone living could remember. The like had never been seen in this kingdom. Sir James Balfour, Some Short Memorials and Passages of This Year, Scotland, 1649. If one ever had to believe in the Last Judgment, I think it is happening right now. Judge Renaud de Sévigné, Letter, Paris, France, 1652. The elements, servants of an irate God, combine to snuff out the rest of humankind. Mountains spew out fire, the earth shakes, plague contaminates the air. Jean-Nicolas de Parival, Abrégé de l'Histoire de ce siècle de fer, Short History of This Iron Century, Brussels, South Netherlands, 1653. A third of the world has died. Abbess Angélique Arnoux, Letter, Port-Royal des Champs, France, 1654. I no sooner perceived myself in the world but I found myself in a storm, which hath lasted almost hitherto. John Locke, First Tract on Government, London, 1660. Because of the dearth sent to us by God, we wanted to sell our property to our relatives, but they refused, and left us to die from hunger. Gavril Nitsa, Moldavian peasant, 1660. Transylvania never knew such misery as this last year. Mihail Teleki, Chancellor of Transylvania, Journal, 1661. So many prophets and prophetesses arose in all the cities of Anatolia that everyone believed wholeheartedly that the end of days had come. These were indeed miraculous occurrences and wonders, the like of which had never happened since the day the world was created. Leib ben Euser, Beschreibung von Shabbatai Tzvi, Description of Shabbatai Tzvi, on events in the Ottoman Empire in 1665-66. The world was aflame from the time I was 15, 1638, to the time I was 18. Enomoto Yazaimon, Oboi Gaki, Memoranda, Saitama, Japan, 1670. Since 1641, I am not afraid of seeing dead people, because I saw so many of them at that time. Yao Ting Lin, Linian Ji, Record of Successive Years, Shanghai, China, circa 1670. Many people held their lives to be of no value, for the area was so wasted and barren, the common people so poor, and had suffered so much, that essentially they knew none of the joys of being alive. Every day one would hear that someone had hanged himself from a beam and killed himself. Others, at intervals, cut their throats or threw themselves into the river. Huang Liu Hong, Fuhui Quan Shu, Complete Book Concerning Happiness and Benevolence, about events in Shandong, China, circa 1670. Preface to the paperback edition. This is a big book. Hollowed out, it would serve as a mausoleum for Ronnie Corbett, though hopefully not for some time. Thus, Hugh MacDonald began the first review of Global Crisis to appear in print, in Herald Scotland, in March 2013. Most subsequent reviewers also referred to the size of the book. A few of them, even as they wondered why I had not added yet more pages to address other issues. We are not told, wrote sociologist Jack Goldstone. Why did the scientific revolution succeed in Europe, while similar efforts at more rigorous empirical investigation in other regions petered out? Why did northwestern Europe's gains in income and productivity in the 18th century not simply get diluted by more rapid population increase, as happened in southern and central Europe? For that matter, why did China, which also experienced gains in long-distance trade and agricultural productivity in the late 17th and early 18th century, fail to build on these trends and make further gains? These are, indeed, fascinating and important questions, although, as Goldstone conceded, it would take perhaps hundreds more pages to answer. Most readers would surely endorse Samuel Johnson's verdict on John Milton's Paradise Lost. It is one of the books which the reader admires and lays down and forgets to take up again. None ever wished it longer than it is. So instead of addressing new questions or incorporating new research, in this paperback edition, I have merely corrected some errors noted by my erudite colleagues, especially those that featured in two debates and one review article of the book. Nevertheless, I should like to address here two substantive comments made by Jan de Vries and Kenneth Pomerantz. In a thoughtful review article of Global Crisis, de Vries, an eminent economic historian whose work has inspired and enlightened me, stated, "A nation that enjoyed population growth through the crisis era, as well as rising per capita output, enjoys no place of importance in Parker's account, even though it appears prominently in the crisis literature. The Dutch Republic experienced what is now called its golden age during the crisis. Although Parker knows this history well, he finds no place for it, and does not justify its omission." Omission seems an exaggeration, given that the index entry for Netherlands directs interested readers to over 20 pages in Global Crisis, while the entry for Dutch Republic lists over 40. Moreover, Chapter 8 discusses the three coups d'état that shook the Republic during the 17th century: 1618, 1650-51, and 1672, as well as to the misery of 1648-1651, when, in the words of a contemporary, "those towns that prospered most during the war declined during the peace, their industry lost, their merchants diminished, many of their houses up for sale. Endless rain depressed everyone, and grain prices stood at their highest level in the Republic for a century." For many citizens of the Republic, what is now called its golden age was apparent only in retrospect. In Historically Speaking, the noted sinologist Kenneth Pomerantz, who not only inspired me through his work, but also provided invaluable feedback while I was drafting Global Crisis, argued that, despite 16th century warfare, Japan's population seems to have grown by between 30% and 50% during that period, which calls into question Parker's claim that Japan entered the crisis era underpopulated. The size of Japan's population in the 16th century is, admittedly, a highly contested field. Hayami Akira, the pioneer of Japanese historical demography, proposed a total population of only 12 million, plus or minus 2 million, in 1600, whereas Saito Osamu and others have subsequently suggested much higher figures, ranging from 15 million to 17 million. Nevertheless, even if we accept the higher estimate, almost all scholars agree that by 1700, the population of Tokugawa Japan had increased to some 30 million. Japan thus boasted an immense capacity for growth following unification around 1590. And even if the population only doubled, as Saito suggested, rather than almost tripled, as Hayami argued, such growth, which was unparalleled in the 17th century world, was only possible because of an initial demographic cushion. Japan really was different. Inevitably, new information about the global crisis has appeared since I completed my text, some in new sources, and others in old material examined in different ways. Thus, Chapter 19 discusses how alarming information about revolutions spread during the 1640s from one European capital to another, but it does not address a question posed by a colleague. Did it also reach the Tokugawa regime in Edo? When I checked the records of the Dutch East India Company, I found a copy of a letter sent from Batavia on the 28th of June 1642 by Governor-General Antonio van Diemen to the Royal Council of Japan, providing a full account of the Portuguese Revolution. 5 years later, a Dutch delegation sent to Edo reported an animated discussion with the Shogun's leading advisers about the progress of the Dutch Republic's war with Spain and Portugal, revealing that the Japanese government had already learned a good deal from other sources. While in August 1650, the Dutch provided the magistrates of Nagasaki with an account of the execution of Charles I, brought by a ship that had just docked at the Dutch factory at Dejima in Nagasaki Bay. The magistrates decided to send an express courier to Edo. It may have taken 20 months, but the horrifying news of the regicide eventually spread from one end of Eurasia to the other. In 2009, in his introduction to a special issue of the Journal of Interdisciplinary History on the crisis of the 17th century, interdisciplinary perspectives, Theodore K. Rabb observed, "Like it or not, the crisis seems here to stay." While 3 years later, in the American Historical Review, Julia Aidney Thomas reminded us that climate change, or climate collapse, and all of its related global transformations is a world-altering force, one more devastating and more definitive than any other. She called for an environmental turn in our field, one that foregrounds climate as a protagonist in human affairs. As if in answer, over the winter of 2013-14, several new books that link climate and history appeared. Hundreds of scholars attended the dozen or so panels at the annual meeting of the American Historical Association devoted to some aspect of the impact of climate on history. And the Journal of Interdisciplinary History published a special forum on The Little Ice Age, Climate and History Reconsidered, in which historian Sam White and climatologists Ulf Bundkin and Lena Hellmann documented the robustness and uniformity of evidence from around the world that a dramatic episode of global cooling occurred in the 17th century. The range of these scholarly endeavors demonstrates not only that the global crisis is here to stay, but also that climate formed an integral part of the fatal synergy that produced it. Prologue. Did someone say climate change? Climate change has frequently caused or contributed to widespread destruction and dislocation on Earth. After the various advances and retreats of glaciers, each one a major climate-related event, about 12,000 years ago, a final episode of global cooling wiped out most species of large mammals, such as the mammoths and saber-toothed cats. About 4,000 years ago, societies in South and West Asia collapsed amid general drought, while between AD 750 and 900, drought on both sides of the Pacific fatally weakened the Tang Empire in China and the Maya culture in Central America. Then, in the mid-14th century, a combination of violent climatic oscillations and major epidemics halved Europe's population and caused severe depopulation and disruption in most of Asia. Finally, in the mid-17th century, the Earth experienced some of the coldest weather recorded in over a millennium. Perhaps one-third of the human population died. Although climate change can and does produce human catastrophe, few historians include the weather in their analyses. Even in his pioneering 1967 study, Times of Feast, Times of Famine, A History of Climate Since the Year 1000, Emmanuel Leroy-Ladurie averred that, in the long term, the human consequences of climate seem to be slight, perhaps negligible. By way of example, he stated that it would be quite absurd to try and explain the French Rebellion between 1648 and 1653, known as the Fronde, by the adverse meteorological conditions of the 1640s. A few years later, Jan de Vries, a distinguished economic historian, likewise argued that short-term climatic crises stand in relation to economic history as bank robberies to the history of banking. Historians are not alone in denying a link between climate and catastrophe. Richard Forty, a noted paleontologist, has observed that there is a kind of optimism built into our species that seems to prefer to live in the comfortable present rather than confront the possibility of destruction, with the result that human beings are never prepared for natural disasters. Extreme climatic events therefore continue to take us by surprise, even if they cause massive damage. In 2003, a summer heatwave that lasted just 2 weeks led to the premature death of 70,000 people in Europe, while in 2005, Hurricane Katrina killed over 2,000 people and destroyed property worth over $81 billion in an area of the United States equivalent in size to Great Britain. In the course of 2011, over 106 million people around the world were adversely affected by floods, almost 60 million by drought, and almost 40 million by storms. Yet although we know that the climate caused these and many other catastrophes in the past, and although we also know that it will cause many more in the future, we still convince ourselves that they will not happen just yet, or at least not to us. Currently, most attempts to predict the consequences of climate change extrapolate from recent trends. But another methodology exists. Instead of hitting fast forward, we can rewind the tape of history and study the genesis, impact, and consequences of past catastrophes using two distinct categories of proxy data, a natural archive and a human archive. The natural archive comprises four groups of sources. 1. Ice cores and glaciology, the annual deposits on ice caps and glaciers around the world, captured in deep boreholes, provide evidence of changing levels of volcanic emissions, precipitation, air temperature, and atmospheric composition. 2. Palynology, pollen and spores deposited in lakes, bogs, and estuaries capture the natural vegetation at the time of the deposit. 3. Dendrochronology, the size of growth rings laid down by certain trees during each growing season reflects local conditions in spring and summer. A thick ring indicates a year favorable to growth, whereas a narrow ring reflects a year of adversity. And 4. Speleotherms, the annual deposits formed from groundwater trickling into underground caverns, especially in the form of stalactites, can serve as a climate proxy. The Human Archive on Climate Change comprises 5 groups of sources. 1. Narrative information, contained in oral traditions and written texts, chronicles and histories, letters and diaries, judicial and government records, ships' logs, newspapers and broadsheets. 2. Numerical information extracted from documents, such as fluctuations in the date when harvesting certain crops began each year, in food prices, in sunspots observed, or in the number of men paid each spring to steer the detritus that swept down rivers along with snowmelt. And from narrative reports, rain fell for the first time in 42 days. 3. Pictorial representations of natural phenomena, paintings or engravings that show the position of a glacier's tongue in a given year, or that depict ice flows in a harbor during a winter of unusual severity. 4. Epigraphic or archaeological information, such as inscriptions on structures that date flood levels or excavations of settlements abandoned because of climate change. And 5. Instrumental data. Starting in the 1650s in Europe, some observers regularly recorded weather data, including precipitation, wind direction, and temperatures. The failure of most historians to exploit the data available in these two archives for the 17th century is particularly regrettable, because an intense episode of global cooling coincided with an unparalleled spate of revolutions and state breakdowns around the world, including Ming China, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, and the Spanish monarchy, while other states came close to revolution, notably the Russian and Ottoman empires in 1648 and the Mughal Empire, Sweden, Denmark, and the Dutch Republic in the 1650s. In addition, Europe saw only 3 years of complete peace during the entire 17th century, while the Ottoman Empire enjoyed only 10. The Chinese and Mughal empires fought wars almost continuously. Throughout the Northern Hemisphere, war became the norm for resolving both domestic and international problems. Historians have christened this age of turmoil the General Crisis, and some have seen it as the gateway to the modern world. The term was popularized by Hugh Trevor Roper in an influential essay first published in 1959, which argued that the 17th century did not absorb its revolutions. It is not continuous. It is broken in the middle, irreparably broken. And at the end of it, after the revolutions, men can hardly recognize the beginning. Intellectually, politically, morally, we are in a new age, a new climate. It is as if a series of rainstorms has ended in one final thunderstorm, which has cleared the air and changed permanently the temperature of Europe. From the end of the 15th century until the middle of the 17th century, we have one climate, the climate of the Renaissance. Then, in the middle of the 17th century, we have the years of change, the years of revolution. And thereafter, for another century and a half, we have another very different climate, the climate of the Enlightenment. But of climate, in its literal sense, Trevor Roper said not a word, even though the upheavals he described occurred during a period marked by global cooling and extreme weather events. The climatic evidence is both clear and consistent. Daily readings from an international network of observation stations reveal that winters between 1654 and 1667 were, on average, more than 1 degree Celsius cooler than those of the later 20th century. Other records show that 1641 saw the third coldest summer recorded over the past 6 centuries in the Northern Hemisphere, the second coldest winter in a century experienced in New England, and the coldest winter ever recorded in Scandinavia. The summer of 1642 was the 28th coldest, and that of 1643 the 10th coldest recorded in the Northern Hemisphere over the past 6 centuries, while the winter of 1649-50 seems to have been the coldest on record in both northern and eastern China. Abnormal climatic conditions lasted from the 1640s until the 1690s. The longest, as well as the most severe, episode of global cooling recorded in the entire Holocene era, leading climatologists to dub this period the Little Ice Age. This volume seeks to link the climatologists' Little Ice Age with the historians' General Crisis, and to do so without painting bullseyes around bullet holes, without arguing that global cooling must have somehow caused recession and revolution around the world, simply because climate change is the only plausible common denominator. Le Roi Ladurie was absolutely correct to insist in 1967 that the historian of 17th century climate must be able to apply a quantitative method comparable in rigor, if not in accuracy and variety, to the methods used by present-day meteorologists in the study of 20th century climate. And he regretted that this goal was then unattainable. The sources now available, however, allow historians to integrate climate change with political, economic, and social change with unprecedented precision. Accounts of climatic conditions in Africa, Asia, Europe, and the Americas in the mid-17th century abound, while millions of measurements of tree rings, ice cores, pollen deposits, and stalactite formations are available. Nevertheless, the new data, however abundant and however striking, must not turn us into climatic determinists. As early as 1627, Joseph Meade, a polymath with a special interest in astronomy and eschatology, who...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?